please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Steve from Parkasy.
Wow, we're dimming the lights. Awesome. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Steve. And, I promise to try not to bore you and speak in a monotone manner to put people to sleep with the dim lighting. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there, and for that I'm responsible. And when Dave called me last night, I got to tell you, I didn't want to come up to wherever the hell this place is. Somewhere in Pennsylvania. I didn't want to come up here. I didn't want to come up here because there's a meeting that I love on Monday night, and the couches smell bad. The big books have writing in them. They've got, like, phone numbers from people back in, like, 83 that got out of rehab. And the people that are reading the big books can't read, and they frustrate the hell out of me. But I love going there because every now and then somebody will be reading the big book, and you'll get to see them get it, you know. And like, I live for those moments. I'm going to be really pissed if somebody gets it tonight and I'm not down there. So I'm going to be praying for Dave if that happens, if I get word that somebody got it while I was gone. Because I live for that stuff today. That's why I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you my story, and I'm going to tell you what it was like since coming in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA has given me two things. It's given me a sobriety date, which is October 15th, 1989, and it's given me a home group, which is Parkasy Beginners Meeting, which meets on Tuesday nights at 7 o'clock. At some church in Parkasy. I wish I could tell you which one. It's Dillon, Virginia. That's all I know. Dillon, Virginia. St. Andrews. Thank you, man. And those are two things that definitely I couldn't have, you know, if I didn't come in here and give this way of life a chance. Let me tell you guys about my very first AA meeting. It was in 1983. I was 16 years old. I got into some, you know, normal teenage kid trouble with the law, and they said, thou shalt go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. So I'm going to my very first AA meeting, and I got a lot of other things in my AA story, but I won't use code words like dry goods or alcohol in other forms. If I don't mention them, it's out of respect for the traditions, but realize that there's nothing I didn't do that was on the market at the time that I was out there working on my story. So I go to this first AA meeting, and I'm definitely under the influence because I'm not wanting to go in there. I didn't understand it. I didn't know what it was, and things that I didn't know, I automatically hated. Things that I didn't know, I feared. So I had to have some form of courage in my blood to help me go into this meeting and sit down. And it was in a municipal hall. It was in a township building. It wasn't in a church, which was a plus. Because I also suffer from raging anti-Catholicism at that time. I suffered from raging anti-Catholicism. I was left-handed, and I grew up in a parochial school system in the 70s, you know. So whenever I see nuns and little foxtails, my knuckles start aching really bad. So I'm at this meeting. My very first day of meeting, no idea what to expect. I got a court slip, and I don't know what to do. I'm going in, I'm getting indoctrinated by the other drunks that are walking in. They're like, hey, kid, you got to give them the paper, you know. Give the guy up front the paper. So I give the guy up front the paper. I go sit in the back of the room. They do all this reading. They read a bunch of different things, some of the stuff we have here, some stuff that we don't have here. It was, you know, it was its own AA meeting. And introduce the speaker. Speaker gets up, starts talking. And this guy, he's like walking around the room talking. He's got a coat on, and he's walking around the room, and he's throwing the God word out there, and he's talking about the evils of drink. And about 5 minutes into his spiel, a bottle falls out of his coat pocket. And it wasn't water. It wasn't Sprite. It was vodka. And I'd already put my buck in the basket, so I was pissed about two things. I was really upset about two things, you know, because I knew right then and there that Alcoholics Anonymous was an absolute lie. And all I wanted was my court slip so I could get out of there and be on my way. Now, how bad did my life get that within the next 6 years I would come to this place that I was convinced was a lie? You know, it doesn't get no more blatant than that. A bottle falling out of his coat pocket, and when that happened, he picked up the bottle and walked out of the meeting. You know, you think you've been to those who say they've never been to a bad meeting? They weren't at my first AA meeting. It was a debacle. It was a crime. And the meeting like descended into absolute anarchy, and all the drunks were like, I told you this would happen. I knew they were drinking. Everybody wanted their dollar back that night. You know, there were some angry alcoholics in that meeting that night. 6 years later, I'm knocking on the doors, take me. I'm like, you know, I'm turning myself in. How bad did my life get that I was willing to be a part of something that I was convinced was a lie? It got pretty freaking horrible. You know, in a short amount of time, you know, I firmly believe, you know, I like to read a lot of AA history, and I've read about Bill and Bob and the Ouija boards and seances and stuff. And I really think they put voodoo on people like me, because I came into the meetings and I felt like a damn voodoo doll. You know, what you guys called a blackout, I just thought was a bad memory. I just forgot what happened the last 6 months. You know, you guys talked about like not being able to stop drinking. Alcohol made me thirsty. You know, I felt like a damn puppet when I was out there, and I would get so, it sucked. You know, the old saying that a head full of AA and a belly full of booze, it just made me miserable, man, because I knew I was one of you guys. And I kept like, I come out of blackouts in AA meetings. You know, if you've ever experienced that, you're in a special class of sick people, you know. Like, what the hell type of alcoholic gets drunk and in their alcoholic state decides, let's go to an AA meeting. Right here, you know. And that's why when I got here and you guys said things like stick with the winners, I really thought that was code for stay away from me. You know, because I felt like a freaking loser when I got here, you know, and I had to hang out with you people. So, you know, between 83 and 89, my life definitely took a turn for the worse. You know, and alcohol did great things for me. I'm not going to lie. I had some great times out there drinking. It wasn't all miserable. But at some point in the drinking, it turned on me and I had to drink. You know, let me tell you about my first spiritual experience. It was in the same year, 1983. I had a job. You know, we'd moved from Philly to the Baltimore area, a little town outside of Baltimore. And, you know, Steve wasn't adjusting well to his new surroundings. And the people at school were concerned. I mean, this was like a nice little community. And here I was like freaking Charlie Manson. You know, like what hell have he wrought upon us? And I was always in trouble. And school really wanted me, they were like, you know, they're doing great things with GEDs now, son. You're 16, you know, you really don't have to be here. But they didn't know my mom. My mom was from Kensington. You know, there was nothing I feared. My dad on a bad drunk or my mom any day of the week. It was a toss-up, man, because it was ugly in the Calderbank household. So we strike a deal, and they put me on what I used to call work release. I got to get out of school at 10 o'clock in the morning and go to work. And I got a little job at a little restaurant bar. And every Wednesday was delivery day, and I got to stock the liquor room. It was a beautiful day. You know, I'd walk up the steps, knock on the manager's door, say, hey, I need the key to the liquor room. And he'd give me the key to the liquor room, and you know, I'd go down, and I'd you know, I get to read all the bottles and put them on the shelf. And it was like, you know, being in the Vatican for me. You know, I mean, cause I didn't know what a lot of this stuff was. I was like, wow, that's really cool. And I'd hold it up to the light and stare at it and stuff. And one day I go up and knock on the door, and the restaurant manager throws me the key. And he says, put that on your damn keychain and quit bugging me every Wednesday. The heavens opened up. I heard the angels singing, man. I had arrived. It was a glorious day. And I remember they had a phone down in the basement, and I called my friend up from high school. And I said, yo, what are you doing tonight? He's like, I don't know. I was like, what do you want to do? I was like, I don't know, but we're getting hammered. And thus began a wonderful love affair with alcohol. I love that place. I love where, you know, my boss would call me up like, hey, call in sick to school. I need you early this morning. I was like, great, I'm there. And I would go to work, and I got to hang out with all those people and do all the stuff. And after hours, like, we could hang out in the bar and party with, you know, because we were like a family, man. I belonged somewhere. And it was great. It was absolutely glorious. I was also really into music, and in the Baltimore, D.C. scene, I was really big into a lot of the stuff that was happening down there. And I got together with a couple guys and had delusions of grandeur, thought I was going to be a rock star, and, you know, ended up with a guy with like a 3-foot mohawk telling me that I'm emotionally unstable. You know, how the hell is a guy with a 3-foot mohawk telling me I'm emotionally unstable? You know, how does he feel comfortable saying that? What type of freaking maniac was I? Well, I was the guy that would start drinking, and I couldn't tell what was going to happen next. You know, I would disappear for weeks at a time. I would go underground, you know, and I would come out of blackouts in the most sordid places, AA meetings. You know, I definitely, alcohol had me in its grips. And, you know, October 15th, 1989, I stood on my mom's porch one last time, and I said, "Ma, let me in." You know, because that was my bailout. You know, when I was in a bad spot, when it got cold outside, when the wrong people were looking for me, I could always go back to Mom. And thank God she didn't know you people, because you'd have been like, "Let him suffer." She took me in every damn time, and I thank God for that. You know, because we had the ritual. You know, I would stand out there and I'd be like, "Ma, I'm not going to do it again." And she'd look at me, you know, and she was like 5'4", and she'd look up at me like and poke me in the chest with the finger, and she'd be like, "Steven, this is the last time. I'm not putting up with this crap anymore." And so I would come in, she would feed me, she would put me to bed, she'd do my laundry, and I knew that in a couple days, a couple weeks, I was going to need to go, you know, because I knew at this time that I was a slave. I was a prisoner to alcohol, and I knew that it was going to be just a matter of time, you know. And something happened. I went to a meeting, and they invited, you know, these people knew me. You know, they all knew me. They'd been watching me coming in and out for years. And you know, I hear a lot of horror stories about, you know, the old timers telling people to shut the hell up when they come into the meetings. These guys were glad to see me. You know, they were blunt a lot of times. They'd be like, "You know, we're here when you're ready, kid. I just hope to God you live to get ready." You know, and when I came in on October 15th, 1989, I truly believe that I had accepted the first two steps. I don't know how to work on admitting I'm an alcoholic. I only know how to go out and do the field research. You know, I don't know how to intellectualize the fact that in my gut, I know that one drink will kill me. And I understood that, you know, what I understood about the first step when I came in 89 was that I was going to drink. You know, there was no like choosing not to drink. I knew I was going to drink. I knew for a fact that I was going to drink, and it was a matter of time. You know, I'd been coming in and out of the rooms for 6 years, and I'd seen a couple people kind of get a little different. You know, they joined the cult. They learned to like coffee. You know, they talked about God way too much. But they weren't out where I was. So I knew there was something in here working. I didn't know if it was going to work for me. You know, so I came in, I started going to meetings, and I got a sponsor, you know, within like my first week of sobriety. This is liquid courage, but it's just water. You can sniff if you need. It kind of looks like an Absolut bottle, though, almost, when you first look at it. Damn Starbucks selling you a bottle of water for $3, but God bless America. So I got a sponsor my first week into sobriety, and he was a great guy, and I went through a period of resenting him because he didn't get me into the steps right away. And I blamed him for me not being happy. But he was all catchphrases and rhetoric, you know. I'd be like, "Oh, man, I feel like drinking." He'd be like, "Just don't take the first drink." Like, okay. I didn't sleep for the last 3 days. I could really use a pill. Hey, pray. Okay. I want to hurt you. Steve, I think you need to get a new sponsor. I'm sponsoring too many people now. It wasn't quite like that, but it was kind of like that. And I got a new sponsor, and he was worse than the first one, in my opinion at the time. Like my first sponsor was kind of like me. He was like a loud and boisterous kind of guy, and you know, somebody I'd heard somewhere in AA, like the your best thinking got you here. So I was thinking, well, maybe I need to do the opposite. And I got this guy that, you know, spoke really soft and whispered almost all the time. And that didn't last long. It didn't last long at all. I really did want to kill him. I really did. I wanted to murder this guy so bad. I actually, like, told him, like, don't ever speak to me again. If you see me in a meeting, don't sit near me because I will stab you. I had anger issues, man. I had anger issues. I was like 45 days sober, and it didn't feel good. I was mad as hell. I felt like I'd been robbed because I was 22 years old when I got here, and I was done. And you guys were like 180. You know, you all got to like wreck countless thousands of people's lives, and I was screwed out of that. I was mad as hell, man. So I'm rolling along. I'm 60 days sober, and I know I'm going to drink tonight. I know it. I'm sitting in a meeting, and I know it. I got that itch that nothing will get rid of, you know. And if you're an alcoholic like me, you know what I'm talking about. You know, I didn't feel like I could sit in the room any longer. And I'm sitting there, and I'm sitting there. And I was going to meetings every day. You know, I didn't know what the hell else to do. So I went to meetings every day. And I'm sitting in this meeting, and I'm just sitting there, and I'm sitting there, and I'm, you know, I'm staring at the floor because I knew what the floor tiles looked like in every meeting I went to. Because I didn't know what anybody, I couldn't look people in the eye. Absolutely not. And I had like hair down to my ass. So I look people, my friends used to call me Cousin It. You know, if you remember the Addams Family. And, you know, we clean up a little bit when we get in here. And I'm sitting in this meeting, and that first meeting in 83 is going through my head. And it's just spinning. It's just spinning there. And I'm like, this is all a lie. This is all a lie. They're all deceiving you. They're all full of crap. You know, it's a marketing scam. They're selling books and getting money off these foolish drunks. You need to just go out and screw it, man. You might as well drink if this is it. Now, I'm sitting there and I'm staring at the ground in this meeting. And I'm staring at the ground. And the guy sitting next to me starts to share. And I realize I recognize his voice. You know. And as he shares, I realize I know him. And I realized I drank with him. I realized I ran the streets with him. And I realized he was one of those people that drank the way I drank. You know. And I was the kind of guy, when you passed out, I stole your car. And then I helped you find the jerk off that stole your car when you came to. You know, I took your money. I had no friends. I had hostages. I had acquaintances. You know. I loved things and used people when I was out there. You know, thanks to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I love people and use things today, you know, which is kind of the way it's supposed to be. But I'm sitting in this meeting and I realize I know this guy. And for a brief second, a spark ignites, you know, and there's a ray of hope that comes into me because I'm telling you, I was in the dark night of my soul right there. I really thought that I was screwed. I thought I was going to drink and I was scared, but I was strained. You know, I was scared, but I didn't feel like there was anything else I could do. You know, there was freaking screws loose in my head. They're still loose, but those screws are tightened. And I grabbed this guy after the meeting, and I was like, JD, where you been, man? He's like, I've been in here. Let go of me. Because, I mean, I was shaking him. You know, I was shaking him. And, you know, I said, what have you been doing, man? And he said, I've been staying in AA. He had about 9 months sober at the time, and he had been working the steps with a sponsor, and he'd been making amends, and he'd been doing all this stuff that, like, I thought was just, like, stuff you say. It's just stuff you say, you know. Yeah, turn it over. Yeah. Turn it over. All right, cool. Yeah. I had no idea what you guys were talking about. I was a freaking tard when I got here. I had no clue. I was out of my damn mind. And this guy introduced me to my first sponsor. I didn't pick my first, you know, sponsor that worked the steps with me. I was walked up to him and handed to him. You know, and thank God they did that. Because I didn't, obviously I wasn't capable of picking somebody that would take me through the 12 steps. On my 90th day sober, you know, I got a sponsor and you know, within a week I began the journey of self-discovery that is the 12 steps. And my sponsor at this time was a used car salesman. So I was suspicious of everything he said. You know, I was questioning his honesty levels big time. But this guy, you know, he lived out in Timonium. And he called me up, you know, hey, come on out. We're going to go to a meeting tonight. By the way, bring your big book. And that, like, echoed in my head. I was like, you know, the little devil come up on my shoulders. Like, don't go, Steve. Don't go. Something bad is going to happen. Why is he telling you to bring your big book? What's going on? What's he up to? And like I always did, I followed what somebody in AA told me to do. No matter how much I fought it, the one reason I'm probably still standing here today is because I'm convinced I'm the biggest knucklehead in the room right now. And I've got the stories to prove it. Let me just put it that way. I don't know how to, like, throw a non-profane adjective in there to describe it, but I'm pretty much, I'm the biggest knucklehead in here. So this guy, I go to his house. And we start talking, and we're sitting there, we're talking. I'm like, I thought we were going to a meeting, man. I'm pacing around, chain smoking like crazy, smoking at him because he's getting on my nerves. And you know, all of a sudden, somewhere in the midst of all this, he made it sound like it was my idea to take the third step. I don't know how that happened, but all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, okay, so how do we do this third step? And he starts talking to me about it, and he knew I was really into the music thing. And we didn't sit down and read page by page from the big book. But what he did is he would point things out in the big book to me, and he would always refer back. Like, his experience was validated by what was in the book, which made it more personal for me. And what he did to me, he said, you know, because people were always saying, hey, just turn it over, just turn it over, just turn it over. And like I said, I'm like looking like, what are we turning over? I don't understand. And he asked me, he said, you know, if I bought you a brand new Les Paul, Steve, and you stuck it in your closet and you took it out in a year, would you be able to play the thing? I was like, no, probably wouldn't. And he said, but if I brought you a brand new Les Paul and you worked at it every day, do you think maybe in a year's time you might be able to make some musical sounds out of it? I was like, yeah, probably, you know, if I work at it every day, you know. Sure, yeah. And he said, well, that's what the third step is. He's like, you're making a decision to live this way of life. You know, you're making a decision to work 4 through 11, and if you work 4 through 11, you're going to get delivered at step 12. You know, he said, step 12 doesn't just happen. It's the result of practicing all these principles in all our affairs. And so we began, you know, and I said this prayer with him. I didn't feel good about it. I was getting mad. Like, the next night I went to a meeting. You know how that AA curse, like, you know, they're sharing about what you're going through right at the particular point in time? That was going on. Like, at the next four meetings I went to, everybody was talking about the third step. And everybody was going, you know, I just turned my will and my life under the care of God and I feel wonderful. I felt like a liar. I felt I felt cheap and dirty. And I didn't like it this time. You know, this was like not good cheap and dirty. I felt bad, cheap, and dirty. It didn't feel fun. I didn't enjoy it. Because what was happening was every night I was going home, and it took me about a month to do my four step. And you know, my experience is my experience. If it took you an hour, great. If it took you a year, great. If you got through it, great. If you didn't get through it, get busy. It took me about a month to do this thing. And every night I'm looking and I'm like, I really am an asshole. That wasn't my fault a week ago. That wasn't my fault before. You know, looking in the mirror and seeing who I really was, that was not fun. It didn't feel good. And I was all about gratification. I was all about feeling good right here, right now, because tomorrow I don't know what's going to happen. You know, and everything you guys said in meetings, you might have been saying all the right things, but what I was hearing was that if I do this, I'm going to feel good now. And I wasn't feeling good now, and it was making me mad. It was very frustrating, but I had, if that guy was a liar, he was the best damn liar there was. You know, because he always had the right thing to say to me at the right time. So I go on, I do my fist step with him. And he starts, like, I'm thinking we're done, and he keeps talking. I'm like, stop. You know, I don't want to hear any more of this. And he keeps pinpointing out, he's pointing out how a few of my incidents that I'm talking about all stem from the same defects of character, and how very few defects of character have spread and been a cancer in my life, like so many things. You know, and he'd always remind me, you know, because I kept thinking, like, I had it in my head, and I think a lot of people do when they come in here, that if I just learn to stop drinking, everything will be okay. Well, I stopped drinking, and everything wasn't okay. My problems felt like my problems were just beginning, you know. It felt like my problems were just, well, my problems were already there, but I was finally able to see them. You know, so we did 5, and we did 6 and 7, and you know, he told me to do the whole, like, go home and get with God. You know, he's like, Steve, go home and get with God. And I went home, and I got with God, and I didn't like what he was telling me. You know, because he was telling me to continue. He's like, sally forth, young man. And I wasn't liking it, because I had, you know, in my short life, I had accumulated a bit of damage. And I understood, you know, my sponsor told me, you know, in freaking March of 1990, that if I want to remove my shortcomings, that I need to clean up the wreckage of my past, and my shortcomings will be removed. He said, I don't know how to tell you how to work on removing your defects of character, Steve. You're an angry guy. That anger stems from something. Most likely unresolved conflict in your life. It's like you've created a lot of damage here. We got it in your fist step. It's all out on paper here. Maybe, just maybe, if you start to clean up this damage, you'll experience a little bit of relief. And I did. I got a year sober. They gave me a cake on my year of sobriety. Somebody bought me a balloon. Said, congratulations. And my ego, like, swelled up. I really felt like I'd accomplished something. And you guys would tell me, because I was young in AA. Not anymore, but I was at one point in time. You got to believe me. And I was young in AA, and people would tell me, you're so special, Steve. You're so brave. And my sponsor, the same guy, the used car salesman that I didn't always like so much, would lean into me, and he'd whisper in my ear, like, you ain't nothing but a damn drunk. And I'd tell him to go fondle himself. Except I didn't say that. I'm keeping it PG. Keeping it PG. And he would tell me, you know, and he was a bit of he was like a Viking, man. He was a little bit of a troublemaker in AA. So that part I kind of liked about him, because he'd tell me, like, Steve, those people that are telling you how special and wonderful you are for being young in AA, they're lining up to buy you a drink. I was like, what are you talking about, man? I am special. My mother always told me I was special. Damn right I'm special. I'm sober, damn it. And he's like, you're supposed to be sober. It's like, no, I'm an alcoholic. My natural state is drunk. He's like, no, you're a human being. Your natural state is not drunk. When you drink alcohol, you commit a most heinous and unnatural act. And that stuck with me. And I remember going home, like, you know, I decided to start making amends to my mom. And now, mind you, let me give you a little back story here. I was living with my mom, rent-free. I didn't have a job, so, you know, not much point in paying rent when you don't have a job. Some are sicker than others. I fell into that category. I was quite unemployable when I got here. But, you know, a couple of the AA landscaping contractors were throwing me some pity work. So I had a little bit of money. And my mother had Parkinson's disease. And at this point in time, she'd had it about 12 years. So it was pretty bad. And me, I figured, You know, we lived in a nice house, had about an acre of land, and I decided I'm going to buy Mom a lawnmower. My intentions were good. I didn't run this by my sponsor. I didn't talk to anybody. I just went out and bought Mom a lawnmower. And I pulled up, and I was all proud of myself because I'd been to a meeting, and you guys were talking about making amends. And you might have been saying something totally different, but what I heard when you said you were making amends, I heard you saying that everybody said you were great. And that it's okay. They patted you on the shoulder and congratulated you for what a great job you were doing and what a stand-up man or woman you were. My self-esteem was hurting that day, I guess. And I wanted somebody to tell me I was good, too. And so I buy my mom a lawnmower, and I pull up. I get her out of the house. I'm like, Ma, come out here. And I show her this lawnmower, and she says, Steve, that's really nice. I'm standing there proud of myself. She's like, would you mind mowing the lawn before you leave? I was hurt. I go out of my way to buy you a lawnmower, and now you want me to mow the damn lawn. And that's absolute. I mean, it's funny now, but it's one of those things like how selfish of a jerk can you be? Like, and if you guys, like, some of you would punch me if you knew my mom. You know, my mom was an awesome lady. And she's out there, she can't even stand up on her own, and I'm thinking she's going to mow the lawn. This is like alcoholic tunnel vision. I only see me. I want you to congratulate me for doing something nice. And don't expect anything out of me. So I get on the phone, I call my sponsor. I figure I need somebody to have my back on this one. And I call my sponsor, and he told me to go fondle myself. And then go mow the damn lawn when you're done. So I did. I was out there, and I remember, you know, a week later, she wants me to freaking trim the bushes. And I'm like, Ma, I got to go to this meeting. And I throw my coin on the table. And don't you care that I got one of these? And she said the same. This is where I was convinced that he was talking to her. She said, Stephen, you're supposed to be sober. And I was like, damn. She's in on it with them. They're ganging up on me. They're trying to stick it to me. So the emotional sobriety bit was a little bit hard to come by. But what I did do, you know, I always default to how it works. And I was talking to a gentleman before the meeting about, you know, they seem to be naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. And that's where I was at the time. You know, I was still in the cave. You know, I was coming out, I was walking out, but I was still in the cave. But it was a long journey. You know, it was a long journey to come out because my problem didn't start when I started drinking. You know, and I don't get into the whole debate of was I born an alcoholic? Did I become an alcoholic? I don't care. I really don't. That's for smarter people than me to figure out. You know, I know that when I pick up a drink, I can't guarantee what's going to happen. You know, and that knowledge has sometimes been my saving grace. You know, sometimes it's been my saving grace is that God seems to have implanted that into me because I didn't do anything but drink too much. You know, I didn't journal on my first step. I didn't get a guide, and I'm not against those things. If that gets you to that point where you know in your soul that you're an alcoholic and the drink is to die right away, journal away, man. Freaking blog, whatever the hell it is you got to do. Get there, because it was given to me. It was a gift. You know, some people call it the gift of desperation. You know, that seems to fit a lot of days. So I'm moving on in the steps, and I don't really help a lot of people. And this was one of my big downfalls in sobriety, is that I did a lot of the introspective work. I did a lot of the searching and fearless moral inventories. And I still look back today, and my first fourth and fifth step was a pretty thorough fourth and fifth step. You know, no, it didn't get into all the dirt, but it got a lot of the nasty stuff. Really came out in my first one at 4 months sober. And in the Baltimore area where I was, that was sacrilege. Like, people would intervene. Like, they would be like, he can't do that. He's too sick to do an inventory. And it's like, that's like saying you're too sick to take medicine. That's alkalogic in its purest form right there, man. You're so sick, we can't treat you yet. And there is, you know, there is some basis for that, you know. I can sometimes be a bit of a big book quoter, and I try not to be. But, you know, on page 95 of the big book, it does tell us that, you know, sometimes a new man is anxious to begin at once. This is sometimes a mistake. You know, the problem is I can't determine that. I'm blessed to sponsor a bunch of guys right now. And, you know, I can't sponsor any two of them the same. You know, because they're all different people. They're all coming from different places. I got a guy that's like 45 days sober. Whenever he calls me up, my first thing is, I'm like, who the hell are you helping right now? What are you doing for somebody else right now? And I got a guy that's like 7 years sober, and I don't want him going near a newcomer. I won't tell him that, but I'm thinking in the back of my head, like, dude, you need to be quarantined. You're so freaking crazy. And I don't know whether that's a blessing or a curse either, but sometimes, like, the sickest of the sick seem to show up at my front door. And that leads me to my marriage in AA. Yeah, I got married in AA. I got divorced in AA. Bought a house in AA. Gave a house in AA away. You know, at about 4.5 years sober, just before my 5th year of sobriety, I was living with this woman, and one morning she woke up, and I was still trying to do the rock and roll thing. I was still, I was still out playing music, and the good thing was, is I was at least on sane enough ground to where I wasn't treading thin ice. I wasn't walking thin ice. You know, you play music, you play in bars. You know, AA had freed me up enough to where I was pretty free to go a while. I was still off my rocker. And I still, you know, occasionally did things like get into fist fights and some other stupid, like, 20-something-year-old. I don't know if it was, like, bad AA program or just being, like, a young man in America, you know, because I was still a bit of a knucklehead. And no matter how much I talked about God, there was the occasion for a fist to fly now and then. But this girl, you know, this girl and I were living together, and I woke up one morning and she said, Steve, you're going to be a dad. And I remember, like, I think after I passed out and I came to and I did a lot of soul searching, you know. And my childhood was not a happy childhood. My childhood was brought up in an alcoholic household. I didn't know whether I was going to, you know, get the crap knocked out of me when my dad came home or get hugged. You know, I didn't know. I got scars, physical and emotional scars at this time that are still there very much with me. And, you know, I look around at my surroundings and I'm like, we're not raising no kid like this. And, you know, I went to my sponsor. You know, I saw guidance from another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody that I had respected. And we started talking. And, you know, he didn't tell me to do this, but I ended up at a recruiting office. And I was 27. Yeah, 27 years old, I guess. So not quite young enough to be like a young, stupid guy, but still pretty stupid. And I go into the Air Force. You know, I'm like, well, they're pretty chill. I'm going to go join the Air Force. And I didn't have no health insurance. You know, I didn't have anything. I had a job, but I'd just gotten laid off. And I was doing all the right things finally. And I was feeling like I was getting screwed because, you know, if I'm doing the right things, good things should happen to me. You know, and you hear that all the times in AA. You hear, like, you know, the rewards of the program and how we get our families back and how this and that and all these wonderful things happen. We win the lottery. You know, everybody loves us. And to me, I look at the rewards of the program because there's people in here that don't ever get their families back. Does that mean they're not working a good program? Hell no. The reward of the program is living a spiritual life. You know, is having harmony. Regardless of what's going on around me, because outside circumstances will not make me happy. They can enhance the happiness that I already have, or they could be just another thing where people go, look, he's got all that and he's still an angry bastard. Yeah. But anyway, I'm at the Air Force recruiter's office and, you know, we're talking and he's all happy. He's like, wow, this guy's like really eager to get in the Air Force. And he pulls out his paperwork and we're talking and he asks that question. The dangerous question. Have you ever been in trouble with the law? you guys taught me to be honest, and you kind of screwed me on this. Because I could say anything in an AA meeting, and you guys will pat me on the back, and you say, oh, you're so honest, Steve. We really appreciate your raw, intense honesty. And what it was, I wasn't passionate about recovery. I was just angry. You know, and sometimes that raw emotion's raw emotion. It's not always like, you know, great. You know, sometimes restraint is called for. But I'm telling this guy my stuff, and I'm like, yeah, you know, tell him about my DWIs, all the other good stuff that happened. Tell him about getting arrested for public urination at the Inner Harbor, and, you know. I'm waiting for him to laugh, because that's what you guys did. Oh, jocularities. And he's not laughing. And as I'm talking, he puts the pen down, and he's just staring at me like, what are you doing here? And I stop, and I'm like, yo, dude, keep writing. This is good stuff. Keep going, man. I don't do that anymore. You know, I almost want to pull out my A coin and show him, you know, and be impressed. And, you know, he tells me to go fondle myself. And I walk out, I'm dejected and, you know, feeling like a loser, feeling like, you know, I'm trying to do the right thing and I'm getting screwed by the man, you know. I was still into that punk rock thing, you know. The man was always trying to keep me down. Little did I know I was the man. How confused we are in our youth. So the Navy recruiter calls me over. He's like, yo, buddy, psst, come here. Oh, yes. Navy recruiter calls me over. And he goes, you know, man, I couldn't help but hear you in there because you're loud as hell. And he asked me, it was funny, he asked me, he's like, are you from Philadelphia? I'm like, yeah, I'm from Philadelphia. Why? He's like, because nobody in Philadelphia whispers. And, you know, he's talking, he's like, yo, you know, that was really good, man. I appreciate your honesty. Usually I get guys down to the MEP station and find out they got a bench warrant out. So my ego. All right. This is a man who obviously knows what he's talking about. I'll talk to him. And we start talking, and he asked me, he's like, are you a friend of Bill's? And I felt like a gay dude being outed. Nobody had ever asked me that question before. Nobody had ever asked me outside of AA, are you a friend of Bill's? You know, and I'm like, who wants to know? And it was at that point I realized he had a 24-hour day book on his desk, and my recruiter was in the program. You know, and this guy jumped through hoops for me. Once again, I don't know how honest of a program he was working. And called a lot of things into question on the journey of you know, December 94 to January 5th of 1995 when I landed in Great Lakes, Illinois. And, you know, this guy, you know, he wrote letters to judges. And I got a letter from a Baltimore District Court judge telling me, you know, that we've expunged most of your record. And I was actually cool with that. I was okay. I was like, wow. Yeah, and I didn't, I just had dumb guy stuff. I didn't, you know, I wasn't like out doing armed robberies or anything like that. I just did a lot of dumb kid stuff. So, you know, he expunged a lot of my record and I was able to join the Navy. You know, and I'm down in Texas. I get stationed in Dallas, Texas, and I don't like AA in Dallas, Texas. They don't do it right. They don't even say alcohol right. They say alcohol. You know? And they introduce themselves. It takes 25 minutes to introduce yourself. They got like 7 first names. You know? My name is Bubby Eugene Joe Jack Buchanan, and I'm sober today through the love and glory of our Lord and Savior Jesus. And if you got a problem with that, I suggest you call your sponsor. If you don't have a sponsor, here's my number, 817-792. I'm like, holy crap, man. Holy freaking crap. So once again, Steve goes back into his difficulty in adjusting phase. You know, and I had a hard time, and it actually started me on the second dark night of my soul. You know, and I started to walk away from Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I never picked up a drink. I didn't have to, you know. A state of mind that I like to refer to as being stark raving sober. That's what I became. You know, I didn't pick up a drink. I went back to school. I did a lot of positive things. And I mean, I was raising two kids. I was married, and marriage was horrible. You know, both sides of the street were really screwed up. And, I went back to college. I started getting educated. I did a lot of positive things. But what I didn't do, once again, is I wasn't plugged into my higher power. You know, I didn't become a conduit of God's grace on earth. Because, you know, the big book tells me that our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service. That's not just in the AA meeting. That's 24/7. You know, that's 7 days a week. That's not something that we do now and then and just be like. And I would show up at a meeting now and then. You know, I got stationed up in Willow Grove, and I went to a meeting and I didn't like it, and I didn't like the people in AA, and you know, my life started to fall apart, and I was disconnected from Alcoholics Anonymous. And in January of 2012, or 2002, excuse me. January 2012, it ain't even here yet. Edit that on the tape, please. Fix that. God forbid an alcoholic not tell the truth. You know, I found myself sitting in a bar. Now, I've been in bars. I've been in nightclubs plenty of times and been on solid spiritual grounds and been fine. I'm not a believer that I should run from life. You know, I'd sat through many family gatherings. My family is Irish and Scottish. You know, we are very much stereotypical Irish and Scottish. We drink and fight. It's what we do. And so I'd been, you know, an AA gave me the freedom to go back to that, but I wasn't plugged into the 12 steps anymore. And I'm sitting in a bar, and I'm looking around, and I'm watching everybody. And a thought goes through my head, like, it was just a phase. You were just a kid. It'll be different. And God tapped me on the shoulder that night, you know, and God took me to a place and time where it wasn't okay and it wasn't all right. And it was near the end of my drinking. And, you know, this is where some of the other substances I did come into play that I won't get into. But I found myself in a section of the city needing some cash. And I found a guy laying in a park, and he was dead. I took his money and I walked away. He was about my age. Had his license. Could have called the police. Could have. He deserved it. He absolutely deserved it. His mother deserved to know where her son was that night. But the hunger was greater than the humanity. And that's where it took me. And I sat in that bar that night and was taken there. You know, and not by my own doing. I wasn't trying to think through the drink. I wasn't trying to come up with a mental tool to help me freaking figure it out. I was sitting there and I was foaming at the mouth. Why can't I drink? And somebody tapped me on the shoulder and took me there. And I couldn't drink that night. You know, the next night I found myself in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found the man that became my sponsor, who's my sponsor today. And we went back into, we got into the steps, and he was kind of passive. I had to like kind of spar with him to be like, come on, man, let's get into some action. I'm off my rocker here. We need to do some work, old man. Come on. You know, and we really got into the 11th step. You know, I found out where his passion was, and I really started to run with that, with this guy. And you know, one of the things that he, you know, one of the things that really hit home with me through working with my current sponsor was that prayer and meditation is great stuff. But if all I'm doing is uttering a prayer, all I'm doing is reciting words. You know, if my life doesn't become a prayer, if I don't take the St. Francis prayer and try to make that my life, then I'm not doing the service that God has me here to do. Because I was given sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'd like to pat myself on the back and be like, you know, yeah, I did this. I think there should be an AA of the Year award sometimes, and I'm sure I'd get it. You know, I'm certain I'd get it. You know, but you know, that 11th step is the one that keeps me growing. You know, that's the one, because I have to constantly try to enlarge my spiritual life. And you know, I haven't been pulled to go back to any organized religion. But I also don't have, you know, I had like resentments against, you know, when I was in Texas, and today, you know, when somebody mentions the God of their understanding, calls them by name, I'm happy for them. I genuinely am happy for them. It doesn't, you know, I don't go, that doesn't belong in AA. I don't get on my high horse and I don't want to call in the make-believe AA SEAL Team 6, you know, to extract that perpetrator, get him out of here. Yeah, there is one in my mind. In my mind, there is one. Jay, you know it. You know they exist. You've seen them too, I'm sure. But that 11th step has been freeing, you know, because what it reminds me to do is it reminds me of my purpose on this earth. And you know, and I'm not good at doing like quiet time. My head rattles too much. I'm you know, I've got 11 things going on at once on any day of the week. You know, I'm still in the Navy. I'm coming up on 16 years in the Navy, and I'm not supposed to have a job. That's like the biggest sham of all times. Me serving the people of America. I'm protecting you from me. That's what I'm doing. Like, that's a joke, but it's, you know, God is funny, man. God is really funny because I've been put in that position to be of service on a whole new level. And we're almost out of time. I'm going to end with this. A couple months ago, my commanding officer decided to. I was voluntold. There's another great. That's something that I learned in the military that's bled over into my AA life, because I've been voluntold. I was voluntold to be the drug and alcohol program administrator for my command, and I've actually avoided wearing like the AA title at work. You know, everybody knows I don't drink. You know, if anybody here is ex-military, ex-Navy, you know anything about chief's initiation, you know there's alcohol involved. And it's, you know, you would call it abuse. I call it training, but I still have a twisted mind. You know, and they would beat the hell out of us for a couple of weeks, and then they throw a party. And like, come on, Stevie, have a beer. And I'm like, no, thanks, I don't drink. And, you know, you get some salty, crusty son of a bitch, but like, I don't trust a man that won't have a beer with me. And I throw it right back at him. I'm like, well, I wouldn't trust anybody who would have such a stupid philosophy on life. And I'm giving him my phone number, and I'm like, dude, you might need a designated driver some night. You might need to call me. But anyway, you know, my commanding officer, look, I digress a lot, all right? Just deal with me, please. My commanding officer decides, in his own infinite wisdom, I'm voluntold. He's like, Chief Kolderbank, I need you to be the command DAPA. And this time, the second time in my military career, I break my anonymity. And I said, sir, I don't really think it's a good idea. I said, I'm already a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if one of our sailors sees me at a meeting, they might feel like the command is watching them. And he said, so you're a member of AA, right? I was like, yeah. He's like, well, they're going to see you at meetings anyway, right? I was like, yeah. He's like, well, they'll get over it. And I tried to argue with it, but he said, no. So now I'm not like any type of alcoholic counselor or anything like that, but what I've gained in AA is it's got to be, you know, what I take from that is my AA life has to be my life. You know, and I don't have to wear it. I don't have like AA shirts. I don't have like drunk junk that I put on my car and, you know, Bill Wilson is my homie type stickers. And once again, that's cool. If that's your thing, I don't do it. It's not something that I do. But Alcoholics Anonymous has to be my life in order for me to live a happy and joyous life. You know, I've tried it without. I stayed out of AA for almost 7 years and I became absolutely miserable. I hit a bottom that was unlike anything that I ever hit. You know, I wanted to drink. I wanted to do horrible things to horrible people. You know, I found myself in a world of hurt. And the only thing that got me through that was these 12 steps. You know, this is the best treatment I ever allowed myself to take part of, you know, and I'm truly grateful that I've been given the chance to be a part of this fellowship. And today, you know, I used to have to be sober. Today I get to live sober. You know, and that's a wonderful difference. You know, and I thank you all for letting me come out here and meet you.